and I'm joined by authors James Valiant and Warren Fahey of the book Creating Christ. Obviously, my first question is to both of you, is what was the first moments? Like the very, very beginning.
Let's start. Well, I guess I get the credit for the initial impetus, but I'll tell you, it was essential that I have Mr. Fay help me. But what I had when I was a young person and a Christian, I studied Christianity at length. So I had all this knowledge about the New Testament, practically memorized in my head the New Testament, but I became an atheist. And I sort of, like a lot of atheists, you know, well, that's not important anymore, and sort of shelved that whole body of knowledge. And but I knew I wanted to go back and look at, you know, the history of it all. And when I started doing so, yeah, this was back in the early 80s, I was literally at the downtown LA Public Library, that cool Art Deco building there, reading the works of Josephus when certain ideas came to me. Now, I think there was some mental preparation other than just being a former Christian, though. I think one of the things that has blinded a lot of scholars to this truth that I regard as pretty much just sitting under everybody's noses, the evidence, I think, is very powerful. And you ask yourself, why didn't people notice it before? It's not a question of the evidence being available or it suggesting what we say it does. I think it's the belief that Christianity is a kind of moral idealism, and that the ethics that Jesus announced was a good thing, and kind of it was a statement of true morality. And who could question the benevolence of the ethics of the Sermon on the Mount? And even atheists, even critical biblical scholars, basically accept that. Take Thomas Jefferson, who, when he did his translation of the New Testament from Greek, he did his own Greek translations, he cut out all the miracles because he didn't believe in magic and miracles, but he kept the moral teachings of Jesus because, geez, after all, Jesus was a moral, idealistic, terrific guy, the best moral philosopher ever, said Thomas Jefferson. And that was Thomas Jefferson, an Enlightenment figure who was relatively skeptical and secular for his time. I think it was philosophy that first really did it for me, and I would have to credit philosophers like Friedrich Nietzsche and especially Ayn Rand for clearing the decks of the idea that there was any kind of moral idealism to Christianity, that that it was anything other than really an attempt to manipulate people politically. And that sort of obviously set Nietzsche said Christianity was a slave morality. Karl Marx, and I'm no communist, said religion it was the opiate of the masses. Seneca said that the ruling classes used religion. And Ayn Rand had said that the whole doctrine of self-sacrifice and self-immolation in places like Christianity was really motivated by people who want to manipulate you and get you to sacrifice your life for their goals here on earth. And those ideas conditioned me to look at Christianity and its idealism in it with very skeptical eyes. And so I began to see Christianity as something that has some ulterior motive. Its ethics is not about life on earth, and they're using supernatural justifications basically to manipulate people in really horrible ways, to get them to accept slavery and poverty and violence, to turn the other cheek to aggression even. So, and I don't regard that as a good thing. But with all that moral preamble out of the way, I was then struck when I read Josephus by several things. One being that it was the messianic prophecies of the Jews that most motivated the Jewish war, this cataclysmic war that reduced the temple to the wailing wall it is today, may have taken up to a million lives. Tens of thousands of Jews must have been enslaved. It was a psychological trauma of the time of the first century, and another rebellion, and the large rebellion in the second century would occur. And that it was religiously motivated, that these religious fanatics engaged in, and they can really only be described as fanatics if we accept Josephus, terrorism, suicidal terrorism, mass suicide, rather than being captured. So the intense religious motivation was clear. They were, after all, fighting a pretty hopeless war against the mighty Roman war machine in the first century. But then Josephus says something also curious, that the Roman generals who defeated these messianic Jews were in fact the true messiahs of Hebrew prophecy. And you can take it from me, because I'm a learned Jewish scholar. And I could hear heard that echoed in other ancient historians, non-Jewish, as well as Jewish sources, such as the Talmud admitting that the leader of the earliest rabbinic school at Yavne himself acknowledged Vespasian to be the Messiah. And then I began to think, well, wait a minute, what is going on here? The Romans are politically using the ideology of the rebels whom they are fighting against the rebels. They're using it for their own purposes of legitimacy and deification. What does that imply? Looking back at the Bible in my mind, it then occurred to me, well, it's quite obvious. This is a pro-Roman tract, and in fact, looking at Jesus's prophecy at Roman in Romans 13, and this was the specific one that finally sewed it all together for me. Rereading Jesus's famous prophecy of Jerusalem's destruction, it is clear to me that it was designed to sort of legitimize whoever was going to claim to be the Messiah at the time of the destruction of the temple. And that can only have been Vespasian and his son Titus. In other words, Mark 13 must be a proof text for the Flavian claims that Josephus says that they were making at the time.
Yeah, and
Putting
that's
all
where
that
I—that's where I
imagery
come
comes in.
in.
Yes, I'm done talking. That's what, how it all put together initially in my head. So I cut a beeline to Mr. Fay's house.
Right. At that time, I was a writer, and I had a sort of a room right next to the street with no lock on the door, and my friends would come and visit me at all hours of the day and night, and I just was used to it. And so at like 2 or 3 in the morning, I don't know what it was, something like that after midnight, in
Well,
the
it means your
19.
working habits are sort of like a vampire's, and that you
Yes,
often be
yes.
writing and, all through the night. And this is a very
Right.
common thing for you to do, Mr. Fay.
Right. So it was a good gamble. I would respond and to somebody walking into my home. Got out. At any rate, that was the thing that he first told me. He was completely excited. I think this was 1983 or 4. What was it?
Yeah,
It was when,
1983, I believe.
yeah, you were clerking at O'Melveny and Myers downtown. So
Right,
okay,
big law firm in downtown LA.
yeah. So anyway, I woke myself up, and he told me about the similarities between the prophecy of Jesus and Josephus's description of the exact same siege or that fulfilled the prophecy of Jesus, and how they were using the same literary tropes and everything in common between the two accounts, and it was already extremely persuasive. And but I think we talked till dawn about
Several
all
hours straight, through dawn, I think.
yeah, I think so. And even though I had to work the next day,
Right.
We talked about every single possible ramification of it, and what kinds of evidence to look for. And by the end of the discussion, that very, very first discussion, I said so even at the time, then this is a Flavian dynastic cult. And James was like, oh, let's not quite, define it so precisely. But I said, what we need to do is look for coins, because coins are going to be out there, and we need to look at the Roman Flavian coins. And we'll find something, because these are Romans. They advertise everything they do. They're in control. Why wouldn't they? So there must be some kind of fingerprint there. So, but at the time, see, we immediately dove in and started to look in different directions for the kinds of evidence that we would need to prove this case. And I tried to look. I actually went down to San Diego, where James's mother lives, and I stayed there for a while. Went to the UCSD library and tried to find texts or books that would tell us what the coinage of the Roman emperors was at the time. And they were so surface and skimming of the, because there's such a vast catalog of Roman coinage, that they only very lightly touched on every single emperor, and it wasn't in an organized way, and the catalogs just weren't any good for trying to research an exhaustive catalog. So that continued through the years, and I would, through the next 3 decades, actually, we continuously discussed and researched as much as we could, and James was the keeper of the texts, let's put it that way. When I would come across, and I always had a weather eye for any new book that was coming out that might touch on the subject. And so when I came across like a James Corrado's book, I immediately bought it and had it shipped to James.
He's
And
got the one that got the physical book to me.
yeah, and
But we could
I
find out about an idea. He will get Mr. Fay is the one who could actually carry it through to send me a copy of the book.
Right. So it would arrive and he would absorb the content. And so then also with Atwill's book and with there was a big book of compendium of iconography from the Roman times, which was again too cursory and too shallow for us to be for it to be useful, but it was a very expensive college text book. But then finally Atwill came out and we was, oh shit, you know, that this is that's it. You know, he's the first person we'd ever heard actually saying Flavian. We had been in it for 20 years, 25 years possibly, I don't know, 20 years at least.
More than 20 years.
Yeah, more than 20 years. And so boom, here's this guy out of nowhere who has this very interesting point of entry for to get to the same
It's
idea.
it started with the same basic insights that we started with. So in
Right,
so
right.
many ways,
But
we
from a
think about
different
it,
direction,
but from a different direction. That's
which
true.
gave us a whole new dimension of research
We
and
noted
foundation.
parallels between Titus and the Jesus's activities. Our notes from the 80s already have a comparison of Titus descending from Galilee, just like Jesus does, to a triumphal entry into Jerusalem.
Right. And actually I included some of that in a short story I wrote because I was going to Cal State Northridge. And an old dog, you can see it. It's in an
About what
anthology.
year was that?
That was in 1984, I believe. And so anyway, I got an A in the story. But that was a short story in which a woman kind of like recapitulates the entire history of Western civilization. She lives 200 years and she's observing this young person across the avenue from her and trying to decide whether there's a future for the human race. And as she's thinking about the past, she goes through the same evolution that religion did. And in it, it's described how she has texts that her sea captain father collected, which showed that the Flavians were involved in the development of Christianity.
Absolutely.
So anyway, all the way back then, and we were doing that. And then,
Well, and long before Atwill, I have to say, this is a, excuse me if I put on my glasses for a second. This is an issue, front page story in what was then the Journal of the Association of Objectivist Businessmen. It's volume 9, number 2, March and April of 1999, 6 years before Atwill's Caesar's Messiah. And here you can see it's The Origins of Christianity by James Stephens Valiant. And in it, I say, let me just read from page 4. Unnoticed as yet by scholars are the numerous associations between the victorious Roman general's family, the imperial Flavian dynasty, and early Christianity. It is a field that would take a volume to cover adequately, but the evidence is mounting. One of the earliest Christian catacombs began as the tomb of a Flavian lady, Flavia Domitilla, whose husband Titus Flavius Clemens, the nephew of Vespasian himself, was executed for adopting a quote Jewish way of life, end quote, according to ancient historian, and was, according to early church tradition, Saint Clement of Rome, one of the first popes, and the author of an early epistle. The subject would take as far afield as I proceed from there, but this was in 1999. This is on page 4 of that publication, as you can see, what I was just reading from. What we were on Flavian Christianity and writing about it years before Atwill had written about it. I was when Eisenman came out with James the Brother of Jesus in 1997, within a year I had read the book repeatedly, and I was on the phone discussing these very issues with him, as he's acknowledged in interviews.
And we what through the years, through the decades. We would get together and discuss what we had learned from various other sources, and you know, we would decide, okay, look, we have to keep testing this theory. So here's Vespasian. He performed these miracles at the Serapeum in Alexandria, What again were the Jesus miracles? Can we compare those two and see what we find? Oh my God, they're identical. And they're using the same language in describing the miracles that Vespasian performed and that Jesus performed. And so every single time we would hit pay dirt, but we were testing the theory every single time. At every single turn, it proved to be another bonanza of evidence. And so there was no place that we turned that we couldn't find this. Interestingly enough, you mentioned how we were immediately amazed about the first evidence, archaeological evidence of Christianity being the catacombs of Saint Domitilla, well, the niece of the emperor Titus. Now, that is an amazing thing right off the bat. But right there was the famous symbol of the anchor and the fish coming together on either side of the anchor. We knew of that right away. My
Yes.
mother took a trip to Rome. She brought back a souvenir plaque of that very thing.
Right.
And I had it hanging over my desk for
Right.
years.
You did for years, decades.
Exactly. And I never, ever, I kept searching for the icon that would prove,
Was standing right above it, sitting right above it.
right, that would prove a connection. But because the coin evidence was so elusive,
Right.
we weren't able to finally clamp that down and make that connection until the internet made the global catalog of Roman coins instantly available for the first time. So that's when that final link be, was we made were able to make that final link. But
Right.
through the years, we just kept testing every single possible avenue, and we kept finding more and more.
Well, I want to give Mr. Fay the credit that he really deserves. He just hinted at it in the beginning of his statement there, but I was always the skeptical, mentally conservative one at every step. Part of it was I was much more familiar with the general field, scholarly field of history, German historiography. As a historian, I just simply was fascinated in the development of historiography by 19th century Germans. And that, of course, led me to reading early biblical text critics and stuff. And so I was a little more familiar with the field than he was already. And so I sort of knew what the standard view, consensus views were, and those prejudiced me. Those kept me thinking, pulling me back in a more conservative way, repeatedly. By the time I got to this, I had already read, for example, G.A. Wells' works on mythicism, and I'd read Strauss. So I was, and Albert Schweitzer was something I quickly had to read, and so that just was the entree into reading Bultmann and becoming much more familiar, and then catching up to date with much more modern scholarship even than that, and keeping myself up to date. That's what I was buried in. And unfortunately, that was kind of an inertia, frankly, chains holding me back, as Mr. Fay was constantly, and in retrospect, repeatedly, correctly pushing me in the correct directions. He would say to me, "Now, Jim, you have just suggested to me that this piece of this gospel, it could be a proof text. Why can't we say that the gospels are part of this wider imperial movement? Why can't we say?" And then I would start comparing. I said, "Well," and I'd do the standard, BS that you get from academics. "Well, this gospel's different than this, geez, and this gospel's different than that, and they have different perspectives," and that, he would time and again cut through the nonsense, find an essential. And again, as he said, he kept pointing to the need to do interdisciplinary research, to look at the archaeology, to look at the coins, to look at the paleography, and to look at all that other stuff. So it wasn't just texts that I was going by, ancient historians and early Christian texts, and even the Dead Sea Scrolls, which was what I was limited to. And he said, "No, we got to branch out. There are going to be physical, there's going to be physical proof here, Jim, and we're going to find it." And I said, "Well, geez, even if there was, maybe it was destroyed. It's, archaeology. One great archaeologist from Oxford had a great analogy. I know I've used it before. He said, "But trying to figure out politics in the ancient world from archaeological evidence is like trying to figure out modern day British politics by going through one or two waste paper baskets at Parliament." It's really that nebulous and fragmentary, the evidence. So I thought, well, geez, we'd just be lucky to get something like that. But of course, he was convinced that there would be such powerful iconographic evidence. So he was relentless at looking at the coin evidence, and he encouraged my own interest in it. And we knew that this would take evidence. I knew that it would take decades to read the hundreds of books that I needed to, and he knew it would take some time, probably decades, to go through all the archaeological and physical evidence, the coin evidence, that needed to be gone through. But we rolled up our sleeves and we did it, and that's what it took too. The internet. Now explain how the internet helps us.
Well, the internet, the thing is about all the other sort resources to look up archaeological data is that they're always specified in a way that isn't necessarily the focus you're interested in. And so they're all broken up into these pieces all over the world. The collections of these items are also broken up into minor collections and museums and universities and so forth. So the only way to get a comprehensive look at this evidence was finally the internet, which brought all of it together in one searchable place. And that was a revolution. And people are going to continuously find more. There are always auctions that are coming up that have, I mean, for
See,
one thing,
private collections aren't all documented on the internet yet, but major
correct,
museums
yes.
collections and libraries collections are.
Right. And big estate auctions and other kinds of auctions, which are putting out information about all these artifacts that have been scattered around the world over the last 2,000 years, you can now search with one search engine. So you can find these things and they will continuously crop up. There's going to be more and more over the years that people are going to find suddenly, and it'll I'm certain just only just reinforce what we found. But that's the big difference that why it took so long and why it finally fell into place. When I finally saw, I kept coming over or coming across the Flavian coin in question here, this especially the dolphin wrapped around the anchor that Titus introduced. It seemed like such a common and a symbol because we've seen it around
Well, see,
lots of
my
places.
first objection was, well, surely every other emperor used this symbol, right? Surely it was
Exactly.
used in other contexts, and so it was like a cliche symbol and doesn't mean much because of that either. So I raised objections like that. Just like me sticking reading only the standard scholarship, and he's the one sending me these crazy ideas from Corona and others. So it is that Mr. Fay was the one who would say, have to overcome each one of those. And believe me, I put a mountain of objections his way.
No, we tested each other, fought each other through every piece of scrap of evidence throughout the book. I mean, there was no, let's go with it because it proves our case. There's
No.
no attitude like that all the way through for three decades. So, but when I found it, it was, and I finally kept researching and I was like, well, what other emperors have used this? And I had to tell James, no, they don't. The other emperors never used this. The coins weren't used. This symbol wasn't used for hundreds of years before Titus used it. And then we saw Domitian used it, but that's it. And then finally we found a coin that Hadrian used.
Right.
And that was a really interesting
Right.
evolutionary missing link.
Right. That Hadrian should use it when he's the other emperor who faced a Jewish war is truly fascinating. There
Right. And by
one
that time,
scholar claimed that it had been used earlier by Augustus in one issue, but that issue turns out to have been a trident, not an anchor issue at all, and more consistent, by the way, with other Augustan issues. And so that did not pan out.
no,
And you search high and low as you will for all the Apollo symbols that emperors in the first 2 centuries use, it really is in the entire course of Roman imperial coinage or earlier. These are the only instances where it was used.
Right. And what's fascinating about the Hadrian recapitulation of that image is that by that time it was a known Christian symbol. So when Titus was using it, it was not a Christian symbol. We're supposed to have no evidence of archaeological evidence of Christianity at the time that Titus was issuing those coins. But now,
Allowed.
when Hadrian is doing it, it is a Christian symbol, and it's also Titus's symbol. So,
Right.
and he's prosecuting the Second Jewish War. So, Very interesting
Earliest
stuff.
physical, the earliest physical evidence of Christianity we have are the second century catacombs of Domitilla, the earliest of the catacomb sites in Rome. It is curious that our earliest physical evidence of Christianity are places just outside the ancient city of Rome and not somewhere else, but that is our earliest evidence, and we can get that from certain symbols and later inscriptions and so forth. But what's interesting is that there's an evolution of these symbols going all the way back to their earliest symbols. And the very symbols that we use to identify this site as both a Flavian site and an early Christian site are the very same images, fish and anchors.
Right. So, Jacob, do you have any questions?
Oh no, I'm good. Keep going.
Okay. But does this kind of explain where we got the idea and how it all kind of came
Oh
together?
yeah, I understand. So it seems so it seems like the idea was already at least somewhat circulating in the public eye quite some time, almost a decade at least
Oh,
before
well,
at what the
my friends will tell you that. Well, I was
article.
a bit of a living terror when I was in my 20s. And
Yes, he could not. Let me tell this because
okay, yes, I think it's even more objective if my dear brother in spirit tell you the story, because he knew me well
it's
enough
okay.
to.
If you were in buttonholing distance for the last 3 decades, and James had more than 5 minutes with you, you were in for a 2 or 3 hour lecture, no matter what the setting was, anywhere.
Or how appropriate might or might not have been at the moment.
Right, and you would
Believe it or not, there were girls I said this to over a romantic dinner at evening. That's not healthy, I'm telling you, that's not healthy. But go
So
on, I'm
that went on for
sorry.
decades. James was, well, we wanted to get the news out, the
Right.
good news. We wanted to tell the
The
world,
gospel, right?
right?
Evangelon.
So, yeah.
No, I was telling all my friends, and more than just my friends, anyone who showed even the vaguest interest, or I thought might potentially show some interest, I would download to them on the Roman politics of the New Testament, on how it reflects Hellenistic ideas, how, and all this thought, because there was a long period in the 20th century where mystery cults and the influence of dying and rising gods was a subject, at least in certain quarters, of comparison. And that stuff I began to be able to see that we could explain far better. What would Messianic Jews of the first century be doing integrating pagan man-god ideas, drinking blood ideas into this into this Jewish messianism? That paradox seems to us to really only be crossed by something like a Flavian cult, Jewish messianic cult.
Well, exactly right. I think that many different books have set out to say, hey, Christianity is really Zoroastrianism, or it's Mithraism, or it's some Egyptian cult, and so they've looked at all the mystery cults and how they have parallels to Christianity. But this, we don't go into those things because this answers the reason all of those things make sense. That the Roman Empire was the confluence of all of those religious influences, and so the fact that Christianity bears the stamp of all of those different influences is only further paralleled to the Roman Empire itself.
And it's so funny when Casey did send me Kuroda's book. It had just been translated. One of the things is Kuroda is a linguist and knows many languages, not English. So we had to wait for Kuroda's book to be translated actually into English. And shortly thereafter, Casey had sent it to me. And one of the things that struck me when I read Kuroda's book, mind you, was that his comparison to Julius Caesar was. Did have some interesting echoes, just like some of these pagan god echoes did, but it also provides the connection to Titus. He wasn't seeing that the connections with Vespasian and Titus were there, the healing miracles, the descent from Galilee. But he has Julius Caesar doing, in effect, the same thing. And then we have another bridge. In other words, the Flavians are the only ones who could explain how these imperial, son of God, savior elements, these Julius Caesar elements that Kuroda is noting, how those could have managed to come in to a Hebrew Messiah.
Before I continue, Jerry Penny, thank you for the $4.99 super chat. Okay, Francesco Corrado, doesn't he compare the military campaign of Julius Caesar to Jesus' ministry? Because
he
connects the exact locations, like, and even some of them even sound like the Caesar's campaign in Gaul.
I'm going to say, give you the proviso, same proviso that I give to Atwell and even Eisenman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have enormous respect for. You don't have to agree with every single thing that they say, and you don't have to agree with any specific identification to see that some of the pattern, large identifications they make are really hard to miss. So, in other words, Eisenman gets the general politics correct, and he appreciates that politics is inseparable from religion. And by putting a political lens on it, he makes the religious differences stand out in contrast. Whether his exact dating of the scrolls is correct or his identification of personalities
is
correct.
Before you continue, James, I just want to say something real quick because there's some stuff being said in the chat. Nothing being said in this video or anything said in Creating Christ contradicts there being a historical Jesus. Continue, please.
Oh, we went out of our way to say that we are avoiding the entire issue of the historicity of Jesus. We were acutely aware of the mythicism issue. We knew of Dutch radicals. We knew of Price. We even cite Carrier in our book. So we're well aware of the debate, but we wanted to studiously avoid it. We did not regard it as significant. I think Roman provenance can be established without any reference, whether there was a historical Jesus. If there was, the high likelihood is that he was nothing like the dude described in the Gospels, quite the opposite, or whether or not it was, as Carrier suggests, totally manufactured. You know, Paul had this Jesus crucified in heaven. You know, I think Carrier's specific argument there is hard to believe, but whether or not it's totally mythologized or not is really irrelevant. The character in the New Testament is highly mythologized. He is rewritten from Hebrew scriptures. He commits miraculous, deeds.
And highly politicized from a Roman perspective,
Mic drop.
Right. And you guys also talk about the testimonium significantly in the book, and that you guys disagree with Dr. Carrier and his view on the testimonium. You want to get into that for a bit?
Well, I can certainly see a reason to get rid of the last linkage between the Flavians and Christianity. And that would have been it. So that would solve a lot of problems if they could just completely divorce the Flavian dynasty from Christianity. And so I can see that project.
Right, both mythicists and apologetics have an interest. Now, normally, of course, it's the apologists who agree with the testimonium being there, but a mythicist who really wants to say that there's no first century, secular source for Jesus needs to get Jesus out of Josephus. I don't think the historical argument turns on whether or not Jesus Christ is mentioned in the antiquities of Josephus. I really don't. Josephus is a dubious enough source, and the nature of the reference is odd enough that I don't know that it establishes a historical Jesus or not, frankly. Especially if our thesis is correct, and that Christianity was a Flavian approved or even designed project, then it wouldn't surprise me at all that Josephus, their leading propagandist, their official historian, would include a reference to the Flavian creation. On the other hand, it also doesn't make one little bit of difference to our thesis. If there was a historical Jesus, say a rebel who was crucified in the time of Pilate, probably because Pilate saw him not as a pacifist who said, pay your taxes, of course, but as a real threat to the Roman Empire. The Romans were incredibly sensitive and nuanced in their treatment of religious Jews in the first century.
Yeah, and two things also are understandable, and one is that Flavius Josephus, working under the auspices of the Flavians, would have been an ideal person to slip some primitive reference to Jesus Christ into his writings. But it's also very reasonable to think that whatever primitive reference he made would have been the perfect place to elaborate in subsequent years.
He's the only guy in the first century who mentions Jesus in a generally available history.
Right. So they would, if it was problematic reference, then of course in subsequent centuries they would attempt to modify it and elaborate on it and illustrate it and puff it up, which is what we see happened.
Yeah. So, for example, we know from Photius of Byzantium that there were competing histories. For example, Justus of Tiberias, Josephus himself mentions, and Photius tells us that guy covers basically the same history and doesn't mention Jesus at all. And he was a contemporary of Josephus. So I must ask myself, if they're going to create an interpolation from scratch, why not include Justus of Tiberias? No, Josephus was selected because he had a reference that could be elaborated upon. That makes much more sense. Now, we openly concede the evidence is absolutely absolutely conclusive. Origen has read a copy of Josephus that he says Jesus was not, he knows it's Jesus called the Christ, but he was not, that Josephus did not say he was the Christ. We also know that St. Jerome, the first Latin translator of the New Testament, had apparently a copy of Josephus where Josephus says, called the Christ. Well, that contradicts all the manuscripts of Josephus that we have currently. All of our oldest manuscripts say Josephus said Jesus was the Christ. Well, that seems unlikely. That contradicts Origen. So we do agree that the testimonium has been tampered with by Christians after Origen, probably in the around the time of Eusebius or just before, and to meet Origen's objections to Josephus not coming out and saying what, you know, was the Christ. But of course, Josephus, even if he, let's imagine Josephus was a Christian, you know, his earliest translator, Whiston, really believed Josephus to be a hidden Christian. Well, let's imagine that's the case. He's writing a general history for pagans. He's, even if he says that, you know, this is a good guy who was called the Christ, he's not going to come out and say, yeah, and this is the true Messiah, even if he was a hardcore Christian. So the testimonium, as best as I think most scholars, and this is the consensus view, there was a reference to Jesus at that spot. That alone can really make sense of the James passage, a separate passage in the Antiquities where he mentions a James, the brother of the aforementioned Jesus called the Christ. Whoa. So that suggests on its face that there was some other reference. And that's why Carrier works overtime to even say this is an interpolation. And that, you know, he has to find two other interpolations and then margin note that comes in. And he's working overtime, we think, to exclude Jesus from Josephus altogether when it really doesn't make sense.
So John Davis says, let me just pull up here. Okay, here we go. Why did Domitian, a Flavian, persecute Christians? What about Diocletian? Every emperor from Claudius to Constantine was pro-Christianity. There is no evidence for this. According to Valiant and Fahey, the Roman emperors created Christianity. When did it end? Okay, so that's a bunch of questions.
Well, no, there's a whole bunch of, there's a very complex answer in this. Mm-hmm. If we read Suetonius and Tacitus writing in the early second century around 120 AD, they appear to exhibit a tremendous confusion as to who the Christiani were. For example, Suetonius tells us that in the 40s, long after the traditional death of Jesus, there was a Crestus who was causing violent disturbances in the reign of Claudius that caused Claudius to expel all the Jews from Rome. Now, our New Testament Christians would not have caused violent disturbances, nor was Jesus around in the 40s, if we believe the Gospels. But in any event, the Romans, like Suetonius, appear to confuse these the Crestus and these Christiani with violent rebels. So does Tacitus, when in the famous scene where Nero fiddles and he blames the great fire of Rome 64 on these Christiani, not Christiani in the earliest manuscript, but Christiani, not quite the same. Now, he does mention Jesus Christ in this context, but he goes on to say these people deserve their fate. So he's assuming that they're like rebels. And there must have been enough of them as early as 64 to be a credible scapegoat for Nero.
Right.
And that doesn't make sense for an obscure batch of little Christians, does it? So we're talking about Jewish rebels.
And the Christian reference is in the Florence manuscript of Tacitus.
Yes.
That,
and
that
it's our
know.
Earliest manuscript.
Well, so, and you know, we have some very interesting evidence in the New Testament itself, don't we? I mean, the apostles of Christ are essentially rebels who are disagreeing with Paul and all of the teachings of Jesus, having a very bitter conflict over that subject. So that was going on. There was a schism. There were two different types of Christianity, or quote unquote, in the New Testament. So right there, we can see there's a difference between the rebels and the more paganized, Romanized mission of Paul.
So no wonder Pliny the Younger, the governor of Bithynia, has to write Trajan around the year 111 or 112 saying, what do I do with these Christians? If these Christians are willing to say prayers in front of an image of the emperor, then let them go. If they are not, then they're obviously rebels. Now, I believe that the Flavian Christians were able to comply with this. They would have had to have been able to comply with this. We know there were Christians in the Roman army by the end of the second century who would have had to have been able to comply with this. So all Pliny's letters telling us is to distinguish between the violent Jewish rebels and these peaceful Pauline type Christians. And those, Pliny, his letter, Suetonius and Tacitus, that's our earliest evidence of Christianity from pagan sources other than, say, Josephus, a Jewish writer writing for the Romans. So outside
right.
of Christian literature, that's our earliest
So
mention.
John Davis asked another question. Well, first he says it was pronounced the same. Then he says, but let's make it clear you agree that Diocletian persecuted Christians?
Yes. The Christian persecution, there's precious little evidence for Pauline Christian persecution. In fact, Tertullian tells us that Roman governors worked to get Christians off. And you can see why. They advocated peace. Paying your taxes. If you were a Roman government official, you'd have every incentive in the world to encourage New Testament type Christianity. It was pro-Roman, nakedly. Honor the emperor, says one of the letters to Peter. Rebellion is a sin, says Romans 13. The Roman government are God's appointed agents on earth. Jesus praised the virtue of a centurion, not just a Roman, but a centurion as being greater than that of any Jew. The entire passion narrative of his disgust is in all four Gospels is a anti-Jewish, pro-Roman allegory and can only be seen in that way. A fictional allegory designed to blame the Jews and exonerate the Romans for the death of Jesus. When you look at all that put together, and as well as the extreme pacifism of Jesus, the nakedly Roman politics of this kind of Jewish messianic belief is bizarrely paradoxical. Nearly all of your Jewish messianic figure thinkers and the believers in the first two centuries were violent rebels. Messiah is a nationalist concept. Messiah is a politically threatening concept. As Mr. Fay points out, the disciples are depicted as misunderstanding Messiah. They have the standard view. The Messiah will be a political and military leader who will lead Israel to independence. The notion of a pacifist whose kingdom is not of this earth, who says turn the other cheek, is an affront to the Jewish idea of Messiah as it had previously existed, as is the concept of a man-god, an affront to Jewish monotheism in the first place.
Right.
So,
right. And the notion that the Roman Empire would fail to understand the causus belli of the Jewish war was religion and not have an answer ready for that contingency to attack that particular cause of the war is not credible.
Well, but through their own propagandists, Josephus, they tell us that religion was the cause of the war, Messiah was the cause of the war, and they tell us that they were using Jewish religion against it in their own imperial propaganda. Our emperors are the true Messiah.
John Davis asked another question. Who was the last Roman emperor who was involved in the Creating Christ conspiracy?
Well, okay, this is important part to discuss. The mission, unlike Titus, his brother, had not participated in the Jewish war. He could not claim the mantle of being Jewish Messiah. Like, and we're not told, as we are told by later historians like Suetonius and Tacitus, they tell us Vespasian and Titus were the Jewish Messiah. They do not tell us that Domitian was, because the Jewish Messiah has to come from the East, and Domitian could not claim to come from the East, nor was his military glory based on his conquest of Judea as his father and brothers had been. So, however, there were figures within his family who had embraced Jewish ways and Jewish culture and Jewish and what we might call Flavian Christianity. The heir to Domitian, after his own children died, he adopted his niece's children to be his own heirs. His niece was married to his cousin, once removed, a guy named Titus Flavius Clemens. Titus Flavius Clemens, we're told, by a pagan Roman historian, was executed for adopting Jewish ways. Well, that wouldn't get someone executed. Being the father of Domitian's heirs, I think we must suppose that he was involved in a coup attempt. That's why both Clemens and Epaphroditus were executed. Suetonius tells us they were executed at about the same time, suggesting that it was a coup, and indeed suggesting it was a coup. Within a year or so, Domitian himself is taken out by a palace coup.
Also, I want to bring up real quick, in the Talmud, there's a character called Kitia Bar Shalom, who is a Roman senator, who apparently sacrificed himself to save the Jews from Roman persecution, and he has been compared to Titus Flavius Clemens before.
Well, the truth is that in the reign of Domitian, the deified cult, the cult of their deified relative, Vespasian, the god Vespasian and the god Titus, the cult involved the worship of them as both gods and Jewish Messiah. A combination we only see in Jesus, by the way, elsewhere. In any event, once they were gone, the leading priest for their cult must have been Clemens himself. So him being an early pope is a very strange garbled memory of something, perhaps. Clemens, as the heir to the emperor's, as the father to the heirs to the emperor, and as the leading priest in the cult of the divine Vespasian and Titus, must have been a leader of whatever form of Flavian Christianity there was. Domitian wanted to return, and this is what Suetonius tells us, to more traditional worship. The archaeological evidence confirms that he was restoring Minerva and Jupiter to their rightful place. Well, what had happened to them under Vespasian and Titus, we're not quite sure.
Correct, yes. In fact, think about it. Titus Flavius Clemens was left alone by Vespasian and Titus after the Jewish war, even though he's practicing Jewish ways?
Or the Jewish ways are infiltrating the court.
Right. Now, how could that be? Unless those Jewish ways were modified in such a way that he could still recognize the emperor and be left alone by the previous Flavians, and yet was objected to later by Domitian.
Exactly. See,
John
so
Davis
see,
asks,
when we hear Domitian, so when we hear Domitian executing Saint Clement of Rome, well, that is to say, if Titus Flavius Clemens was Clement of Rome, and we see him executing Epaphroditus, the patron of both Saint Paul and Josephus, if Epaphroditus and Clemens are being executed by Domitian at the same time, we can conclude that Domitian is cracking down, if you will, on the Flavian Christian element, the Jewish element, within the imperial court.
They had flourished under the Vespasian and Titus.
And that's also why we've been talking about the late dating of Paul to that period.
That creates an open problem for later emperors when the Flavian dynasty goes defunct. Well, the last Flavian emperor was cracking down on the Jewish, the plan to pacify the Jews. Now, remember, the early Flavians were closely connected with high-ranking Jews. The emperor Titus almost married Berenike, the daughter of Herod Agrippa I.
Could you hold that thought for a moment? John Davis asks, was Marcus Aurelius part of the Roman provenance theory?
I have no idea to what extent later emperors were aware. I doubt they were largely aware. They were aware that the Flavians themselves had already reversed the policy by Domitian's time. So they had an open question, what to do with these ongoing Flavian Christian types, if you will, or Jews being converted to a pro-Roman kind of Christianity. It created an open problem. they were paying their taxes, they wouldn't rebel. And so we hear of people at that time, such as Tertullian, working to telling us that Roman governors were working to get them off. So, and by the time of Marcus Aurelius, we hear of Christians being in the Roman army. So Aurelius no doubt had a positive policy, it appears, not a persecution policy, towards Christians. But I have no reason to believe that he thought that all Christians, in effect, were threats to him because they were advocating a return of the Flavian dynasty. Although that too could present a problem to future emperors, you see.
So that being said, I think it would be a good idea to spend some time talking about what are the major differences between Creating Christ and Joseph Atwell to kind of straighten this, some of this confusion.
Well, that's one of them right there.
Yeah.
That's one right there. We don't believe in an ongoing conspiracy of secrecy. There's no doubt, there's never been a secret that the early Flavians claimed to be the true messiahs and that Vespasian committed, performed miracles. You know, he's the only emperor reported to have performed actual miracles during his lifetime, that he performed healing miracles identical to those of Jesus, or boasted about his humble origins, or that stars were prophetic for the Flavians, or that Titus had a triumphal entry into Jerusalem after spending time at the Mount of Olives and descending from Galilee, and so forth. We know that Jewish scholars like Josephus the historian, who is well-versed in Hebrew literature, worked for them as propagandists. We know that nephews of the philosopher Philo, the Platonic Jewish philosopher Philo, were involved in the Flavian court. So they had highly educated Jewish elites working for them, who no doubt needed a pro-Roman kind of messianic Judaism in order to continue to be Jews and still be loyal to their Flavian emperors. Domitian, it appears, cracked down on them, and later emperors sort of allowed it to exist because it was peaceful in most cases. As Professor Candida Moss has shown in her book, The Myth of Persecution, nearly all stories of Christian martyrdom are myths. And as far as we know, there was no law against Christianity until the year 250, and that was quickly reversed. Diocletian, by the time of Diocletian, though, Christianity was so popular that there were Roman politicians supporting Christians. And so now it was, you know, your gods versus our gods in terms of who wins out for who the emperor is. When Constantine becomes emperor, he's using Christian support to become emperor. And that's why, and he probably has Christian friends, maybe relatives like his mother. And so he's using Christianity politically because now it's a political power. And therefore a threat to the enemies of generals who might use Christianity.
Right. So that being said, let's get into the specific differences between Atwell and Creating Christ.
Yeah. Well, the one I would focus on is that there are several that are important. But one, for example, is the simultaneous nature of the Gospels. He, for example, points to in each of the four Gospels, the resurrection occurs at a slightly different moment in relation to the dawn. You know, it was light, but the sun hadn't come up yet. We just saw the light over the horizon. The sun had just come up, you know, etc. And he said, by putting it together like that, you can decode the Gospels as talking to each other, in, you know, to different audiences perhaps, but all part of the same plan and idea. I do not believe that. I believe that the theological agendas of the gospel writers are distinct and different. If they put the resurrection at different times of day, they're not writing in some signature code for us to decode later on. No, the theological perspectives are such, in my view, that whoever's writing Matthew is clearly dissatisfied with Mark and wants to correct it and change it. And whoever's writing Luke is dissatisfied with Matthew and wants to correct and change Matthew, and especially John. He is dissatisfied and thinks there's a whole lot more theology that needs to be put in and a different image of Jesus be presented. So I think the difference...
And they have different political audiences as well. So.
Right. And there's I don't believe in an ongoing conspiracy. I don't think people like Shakespeare, you know about it in secret and stuff. I don't think that there needs to be a secret because I don't think there was anything secret about the Flavian messianic claims.
And everything is... And Joseph Atwell's sequel, The Caesar's Messiah, I guess one could call it a sequel, Shakespeare's Messiah, or Shakespeare's Secret Messiah, that's the full name. That's the full title. He claims that some sort of parallels between Paul and the reign of Domitian, not like the parallels that we've discussed on this channel in the past. He's doing something different. He's claiming that the letters of Paul were somehow post-dating the Gospels.
I don't believe with either Atwill or Robert Viegas that Domitian claimed to be a Jewish Messiah, if that's what either of them are trying to tell us. I don't believe Domitian was part of the Jewish claims, Flavian
Yeah.
claims being the
You know
Jewish
what's
Messiah.
interesting, just from an archaeological point of view, on Domitian, is that he discontinued the use of the dolphin anchor image rather rapidly into his reign, in about the first or second year. Also, he rebuilt the Roman Pantheon, which had been burned down, and rededicated it to the traditional gods of Rome. And he didn't use the other imagery and iconography that we can see in Vespasian and Titus. And we see his coins populated by traditional Roman gods like Minerva and Zeus and other people. So he's definitely distancing, and that, along with the purge, right, shows that that would be a very difficult call to make, that Domitian was still active as in any way with the Christian movement.
So I think we have to imagine the last years of Domitian's reign as very rough on even high-ranking Flavian Christians. Domitilla gets banished, Clemens and Epaphroditus get killed,
Yeah, and
Josephus probably gets banished.
let's point out something. I think this is missed quite often, but when Domitian adopted the children of Titus Flavius Clemens and
Okay.
executed him, people don't quite understand the significance of that. It means that he was threatened by this man for his own title, and that by taking his children and making them his heirs, that kills two birds with one stone. Now,
Right. In other words,
Augustus Caesar did the same thing with Mark Antony's children, for instance.
Clemens taking over the Jewish mantle in the family is a political threat.
Correct. Yes, right.
Fascinating idea there, you see, because there we're being told that he was killed for adopting Jewish ways. Sounds strange, doesn't it? But it doesn't sound so strange when you look at the earlier Flavian claims to being Jewish Messiah. Now his adopting Jewish ways becomes a political threat to the later Flavian who could not claim to be Jewish Messiah. That by itself is fascinating evidence.
And he also tries to claim that Paul didn't exist.
See, and when you get into things like that, I'm not sure. And let me just back up and say, I'm not sure every single attempt to connect Titus and Jesus is successful. I think there are just some things different about Titus that are not found, say, in Josephus. I don't think, in other words, in Jesus. I don't think, in other words, you can read the Gospels as a perfectly encoded story of Titus, as
John
he's.
Davis asks, was Hadrian in Veneau? That was his next question after he asked if Marcus Aurelius was part of the Roman provenance theory.
Well,
I
like.
think by that time he's making a direct appeal to Christianity itself, because the icon is no longer a Fabian symbol. Now it's actively used by Christians in catacombs. So when he's putting it on his coin, yes, he's reusing a symbol that the previous general who fought the previous Jewish war used. He's using it in order to show allegiance to the peaceful, pacified Jewish Christians.
Right. I would note it's a graven image, right? The dolphin symbolizes a god. The fish symbolizes Jesus, especially when connected to the anchor. Fish approaching the anchor might be the Christian follower, fisher of men, but
And
the ichthys.
just to let everybody else out there know, Hadrian in the second Jewish War kicked all the Jews out of Judea.
Right.
And
He was the one
he
that
formed
enforced
that
the diaspora
province,
Roman by
Syria,
law.
Palestina.
I'm sorry? Yes. He
He formed
created,
that,
he put a temple of Jupiter where the Jewish temple is.
Right.
But
So
we're also
that's.
told by Eusebius, but we're also told by Eusebius that Hadrian allowed the appointment of Christian bishops in Jerusalem. So he expels by law all the Jews from Judea, but allows Christian bishops to be appointed according to Eusebius in Jerusalem as he builds a temple to Jupiter where the Jewish temple was. fascinating combination of facts. Using a graven image, which Jews would find offensive, but one that was already used by our Pauline Christians in catacombs.
Now that we talked about Outwell a few minutes ago, this makes me think that it sounds like, to me, Joseph Outwell wants nothing in early Christianity to be historical. So it's like basically saying almost everybody in New Testament is fake, and trying to force Paul not to exist, force Jesus not to exist.
Okay, let me point out one more key difference between Outwell and us.
Sure.
He looks at Christianity as a very scathing joke, a satire of how ridiculous the Jews were in the Romans' eyes. We don't see it that way. The Roman Empire was a religion machine. They had created cult after cult after cult. They had deified three emperors before this point in time. They, more than anyone else in the history of the world, were adept at creating religions that would unify and pacify their empire. So for them to just take it as a joke is too one-dimensional. They would be on top of it, many more facets of the project, of the mission. And that's just simply too simplistic from our point of view.
Right. As we said in the beginning, we don't think there's any need to take on the issue of historicism in this issue at all. And Outwell thinks there is and is a mythicist, which is outside the consensus. But, you know, as Mr. Fay says there, still more important, it would be like calling Virgil's Aeneid a joke or a satire. No, it's obviously a majestic poetic epic, seriously designed to use foreign religion and Greek literature type to legitimize the first dynasty of Roman emperors as the descendants of gods. And
right, that's
cultural equivalent is the New Testament.
Yeah.
Now, for Atwell, everything in the Gospels is kind of a tongue-in-cheek joke. We don't think so.
No, and actually, if you look at, that's one of the reasons we included the whole Serapis backstory, is that the Romans were looking to that example of how to create, almost out of whole cloth, or at least from other elements, a god. And then the purpose of that god was to unify the conquered Egyptians with the new Ptolemy regime. So this is not a joke. This is a very serious element of statecraft that the Romans were employing.
And it's always struck me as extremely odd that other Roman provenance theorists have not looked at the pagan mystery god, you know, God-man elements of Christianity and asked where they came from. Roman provenance, the imperial cult in particular, provides a specific causal answer for how it is that Serapis, Asclepius, Dionysus, Orphic mystery cults, the drinking of blood, a god man, that kind of stuff, basic Stoic and Platonic ideas. How did that make it into Christianity?
John Davis says Hadrian was a homosexual. He couldn't have been a fan of Christians.
Oh, please, yeah. One could use religion without accepting all of its tenets. For example, take Josephus. Josephus praises the collective property, the communal property of the Essenes. He praises their celibacy. Yet Josephus is a wealthy man who had four wives. So I don't think Josephus was an advocate of either poverty or celibacy, yet he thought it was the highest moral pinnacle a person could reach.
Also, let me point one thing out in the New Testament itself, just from a philosophical point of view. When you look at the command to honor the emperor as God's appointed agent on earth, at the time that was uttered, the emperor was a wild pagan.
Right, right.
So in other words, God's agent.
You're talking about someone who had controversial sex practices.
Yes, so God's
agent. A hero has a transsexual spouse.
Right, so God's agent doesn't have to be Christian. That is the emperor.
Right.
For you to be commanded by God to honor.
Right. That imports, I think there's a big lesson here. We cannot import post-Constantine, post-Trinitarian, much less modern Christian ideas all that idea of Christianity, we cannot import it back to the first or second century. There can be multiple messiahs. There's nothing in the New Testament that says there. In fact, Jesus is only one early coming, where there's going to be at least one more glorious coming of the Son of Man. There are
Right.
multiple messianic advents. There could be multiple messiahs. We can't, we
Right.
have to use the language itself of the early Christian literature to know what they thought. We cannot import post-Council of Nicaea, Catholic or Orthodox ideas about Christianity into any of this. We have to have a clear head that way.
Essentially, that command to honor the emperor as God's appointment, God's appointed agent on earth, actually absolves all appointed leaders, political
Correct.
leaders, from Christianity itself.
Right.
They,
See,
if they are de
you got
facto your leader, you can't
Jesus can
question
attack
them.
the temple because you see the rules, for example, about turning the other cheek and not being aggressive only apply to you and me. They don't apply to God or government. And government's God's appointed agents on earth. In fact, Paul's clear about this at Romans 13. He says that's why the government wields the sword, and you ought to be afraid of how the government wields the sword. Well, wait a minute. Jesus said, whoever picks up a sword shall die by the sword. I should turn the other cheek. I should love those who do bad to me. I should be good to evildoers. All that stuff is inconsistent with the behavior of Jesus or what Paul says the government should be doing. So, no, it doesn't apply to the government by the very terms of the New Testament.
Eisenman's view that Saul was a Roman agent, and that the character called Saul in Josephus is our Paul in the letters, which makes sense to me, is seems to dovetail quite
We
nicely.
don't take a stand on that in creating Christ, but I agree with you that the Saul mentioned by Josephus does seem to be the leading Saul the Herodian, troublemaker working for the priests, does seem to be the leading candidate for a historical Paul. But
But
as you
Eisenman's identification of the teacher of righteousness as James and the father of lies that is Paul, yeah, that makes a lot of political sense and historical sense.
I
It
mean,
also
there's a you know, it all hinges on your dating of the scrolls and whether or not his connections are correct.
Right.
But our argument, as we say in Creating Christ, does not turn on Eisenman's identifications like that.
But now that we brought that up, just real quick, it's like, from what I can tell from the people that from the mainstream critics of Eisenman, and from my own research, there seems to be that issue that in the Habakkuk pressure, the righteous teacher, in fact, pretty much in all the other scrolls too, he's running away from the wicked priest, and he seems to think that, well, that it's implied that the wicked priest was slain by the righteous teacher, but it never actually says that anywhere. I remember having a private conversation with you, James, a while back, and you looked at it, and you realized, oh yeah, it doesn't really say he was killed by the
I
right
have always
wicked priest
believed
anywhere.
that the Damascus, for example, if you're going to get into this particular issue, I've always believed that the Damascus document was largely about the founder of the movement back in the second century BC. I always believed that the evidence was open to a range of dating between the second century BC and the first century AD. Now, I also agree with Eisenman that the circumstantial evidence is overwhelming. Since these documents were deposited at the time of the Jewish War by people who were in control at the time, the Jewish rebels,
But
these were
here's yeah, but here's something I'll toss in here real quick.
important.
Sure. Oh,
These
yeah.
were important, beyond a doubt, these were important documents to the rebels. They are important evidence to the ideology of the rebels, whatever their date. So in the book Creating Christ, we go out of our way to say it does not, our theory does not depend on whether or not you agree with Eisenman's identification of personalities or his dating of the scrolls. He has a circumstantial case that we think is interesting, but our argument does not hinge on it, as we say in the book.
Right. What's interesting is, as I discussed in the past, is that there is something, there's a text in Hosea Pesher that talks about that the high priesthood has come to a total end.
See, now that would support Eisenman that at least that document happened at about 70, right? It was in 70 that Titus destroyed the temple, and therefore a date of no earlier than 70 is credible if that's what they're talking about.
What was the lineage, James, that you pointed out, that you discovered of the usage of the name of the Flavius name in Roman emperors after was it the
Oh,
Holy?
this is a fascinating thing. Starting at about the time of Constantine, every single emperor adopts the name Flavius as part of their imperial name. It had long been common. Well, let's go back to the earliest Caesars who weren't part of the Julius Caesar family, right? Gaius Julius Caesar was the first man deified since Romulus, the founder of Rome. And he was a real first century political figure, a dictator who's named dictator for life. The conservative senators didn't like that, so they famously assassinated him, right? On the Ides of March. You can read that in Shakespeare, made famous in movies in Shakespeare. And he was deified, the first Roman politician deified, the first one deified since the founder of Rome, Romulus. So the name Caesar became something that was adopted by emperors even after the members of Julius Caesar's family had lost power. It made sense that his adopted son would have the name Gaius Julius Caesar. He's his adopted son. He has the right to that name. His adopted son, Tiberius Caesar, was also an adopted son of Augustus. So he had the right to the name Julius Caesar as well. The next emperor, Caligula, his father had been adopted by Tiberius. He was born. Caligula's name when he was born was Gaius Julius Caesar Germanicus. So that's why we know him as Caligula. Little Boots is his nickname. The first emperor, not technically speaking, who was by rights a Caesar by name, was Claudius, Caligula's uncle. He still belonged to the Claudian family, but he still adopted the names Caesar and Augustus. And then after Nero, no one was even related to that family. And the Flavians and all the later emperors took the name Caesar. It's a family name. And so titles like Augustus and Caesar became common ways of describing the office by use of the family name that first possessed it, which is a really interesting tradition. Between the end of the Flavian dynasty, when Domitian dies, and Constantine, we don't see the name appearing in imperial names. Now, Constantine, the guy who's famous for bringing Christianity in, legalizing it, and eventually making it the official religion of the empire, from him forward to the fall of the Roman Empire for the next couple of centuries, every single emperor except one we know officially, who only lasted a couple of years, and who was a Christian bishop himself before he became emperor. That was the one exception. But every other emperor since Constantine, through the Constantine dynasty, the Theodosian dynasty, the Valerian dynasty, all the Christian dynasties in the West of emperors, they adopted the name Flavius as part of their name. I don't know why. It is a curious fact. It is hard for me to believe that they were actual descendants of the Flavians, and they only adopted it as an imperial name after their family had achieved imperial status. So they were adopting it as a Flavian
Right.
imperial name like Caesar.
Even the author of the biography of Apollonius of Tyana was named Lucius Flavius Philostratus.
Well, now there we have an example of probably the descendant of a Flavian freedman. If your name is, in the American South, if you were a black slave who'd been freed, you normally took the name of your master. That is why so many African Americans have names like Washington and Jefferson and so forth, because they adopted their master's name upon being freed. The same tradition held in ancient Rome. Once you were freed, it was an honorific and customary to say thank you to your master by adopting their family name. Now, you would almost never adopt their honorific titles, their so-called cognomen. So, for example, if you are a slave of Julius Caesar's or a captive, a war captive of Julius Caesar's who was granted citizenship or freedom, your last name in Rome would now be Julius. So the Herods, for example, Herod Agrippa is Marcus Julius Herod Agrippa. That's his name. And his son, Marcus Julius Herod Agrippa, because he was freed by a Julian. Claudian freedmen, like Felix, who was a governor, a famous governor in the Book of Acts, he's Claudius Felix because the Emperor Claudius had freed him. So at the time of the Jewish War, there must have been thousands of slaves, and in the course of time, many of them must have been freed by the Flavians. And so for the next few centuries, a very common name among Romans is Flavius. And these are probably descendants of Flavian freedmen. But it does show a connection of some kind to the original Flavian family. So Apollonius of Tyana, his biography is written by someone who is almost certainly a descendant of a someone who'd been a slave freed during the time of the Flavian era. In other words, their ancestor, the patron of their ancestor, had been a Flavian emperor, connecting them to, and therefore when Vespasian and Apollonius of Tyana interact in his biography of Apollonius of Tyana, it's curious. Why should Titus Flavius Vespasian be interacting with the subject of Flavius Philostratus's biography, you see, further connecting them? But a name, take for example the Christian writer Titus Flavius Clemens of Alexandria. He's writing a century after Titus Flavius Clemens of Rome, perhaps, but he has the exact same name. This is not likely to be a descendant of a mere freedman. You wouldn't get the name Clemens. You wouldn't get the full-on Titus Flavius either. So a Titus, the Flavians had an odd tradition of always giving their sons the same first name, Titus, even of the same generation. So Titus and his brother Domitian, or Vespasian and his brother Sabinus, were Titus Flavius. Must have been confusing it to the Flavian home. So they distinguished them by their final name, Sabinus Vespasian, right? Titus is the only one known as Titus. Domitian by his final name, Domitianus. So, but if he has the exact same name, Titus Flavius Clemens, 100 years later, then he is probably I'll go so far in my mind to say he's almost certainly a direct descendant of Titus Flavius Clemens, who was accused of Jewish ways, and further confirming that this Titus Flavius Clemens is Clement of Rome, just as Eusebius in a sort of vague way suggests as well. But of course, the earliest physical evidence is the actual Flavian sepulcher, the tomb of Flavia Domitilla. So we have all kinds of evidence that these are the Christians we're talking about, and that the earlier Titus.
Yeah, it is, the book is chock full of that stuff.
I'll shut up. Sorry.
Yeah. But, you know, interesting side note, my mother's maiden name is Hellstrom, and yet we've always been Finnish. You know, she's Finnish, and
that is Swedish
that ancestry. And so I asked her one time, why aren't we Swedish? How are we Finnish with a maiden name like Hellstrom? She said, oh, that's a slave name. The Swedish enslaved the Finns after a war. And so my Finnish ancestors had to take Hellstrom, their master's name, when they came to the United States.
Right. But it's curious to see how many Flavians in the second and third century are also connected with Christianity and Flavian names. Tertullian, for example, the Christian writer. Well, Vespasian's grandmother was a Tertulla. His son's wife's grandmother.
Oh, this stuff gets really thick. it's just
really thick.
Yeah, it is very complex. The way the Romans do that, you check it out. It's very interesting.
And how many times do you have a Titus or a Clemens in Christian literature, including Paul's letters? I mean, there's a Titus in Galatians and a Clemens in Philippians.
Right.
And those are the earliest Christian texts.
Right, right. What are those names doing? That's something interesting to look into right there, really.
Yeah.
Who is Titus?
And who is the Clemens? And
the book of Titus.
Philippians, what we have is a really bizarre connection. We have a Clemens, who is a follower of Paul's. We have an Epaphroditus, who's a patron of Paul's, and we have a reference to all those in Caesar's household sending greetings, and we have a reference to how he boasts about how everyone in the Imperial Guard at Rome, the Praetorian Guard, has heard of Christianity. So we have a Paul that has full access to the entire Imperial Guard, the bodyguard of the emperor. He is sending greetings from Caesar's household and everyone in it, and his patron is Epaphroditus, one of the top freedman, one of the top ministers of state for the Flavians. And he's talking in the same letter about a Clemens, a Titus Flavius Clemens, the name given to St. Clement of Rome. And in fact, it's Christians as early as Origen associated Paul's Clemens in Philippians with Titus Flavius Clemens.
Yeah.
In fact, when they did archaeology on the original church dedicated to Clement of Rome, the guy at the end of the first century, the first Clement of Rome, The first Saint Clement, not Clement of Alexandria, 100 years later, but the first Saint Clement, they excavate it, and in pre-Constantine times, it had been dedicated to Titus Flavius Clemens, when they uncover the rock that hadn't been seen for centuries. So our Clement of Rome was originally known as Titus Flavius Clemens, just as Clement of Alexandria was. And for two of the earliest Christian saints and writers to have an identical name like that, a Roman aristocrat name like that, suggests direct descent.
Yeah, the nephew-in-law of Titus, the emperor.
Right. These combination of this combination of evidence, I think, becomes overwhelming when viewed cumulatively.
I think that gives everybody a good overall look at the creation of creating Christ.
Exactly, and the main steps that convinced us to finally come out with our theory.
Right, and the main differences with Atwill and some others.
Exactly. But we believe in using all the sources and everyone who said something even vaguely close. So that's where you go back to Bruno Bauer of the 19th century, a vicious anti-Semitic writer, but nonetheless the first Roman provenance theorist.
Right.
So we want to include them all. We don't want to exclude any related thinker. That's why we try to integrate them all.
So what I was trying to say earlier about be more... like the more absurd versions that are out there, for example, the post Nicene creation of Christianity, which is basically a massive conspiracy theory that Emperor Constantine and the Council of Nicaea forged the entire New Testament.
Why would you forge four gospels that so contradict one
right.
another?
I know.
No, the gospels precede, in fact, they had to deal with them. And they dealt with them as best they could. Why would you
right.
need a Council of Nicaea?
I might have accidentally came across slightly harsh, and when I was basically trying to get into the distinguishing. But if you're inventing
Christianity right. from scratch, like they claim Constantine did, why would you need to settle an existing dispute about the nature of God? God the Father, the Holy
right.
Spirit, was Jesus a God? When was Jesus a God?
And how,
was Jesus really a God? I mean, there had to be differences of opinion before that.
Right.
And
that's why, that's actually, that, now that you said different opinions before that, well, that's what, exactly what it was about, the Arians. How are Arians?
Gnostics.
How could,
right.
unless, like, you know, like, this is a
why
joke
would
I've
you
used.
Invent heresies?
This is a joke I've used before, but this is it's appropriate for even right now. Unless Arnold Schwarzenegger is time traveling, putting Arians before Constantine or whatever. That's not going to work. How are there Arian Christians before Constantine, but there are no Christians until after Constantine? Doesn't make any sense.
No. Zap. He is appearing in an alley like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
No. The characters in the New Testament are first century characters. Jesus is killed by Pilate. This is all happening on the eve of the Jewish War. So why would Constantine invent a cult that was all about characters that happened just before the Jewish War?
And how could Paul retain
gospels that contradict one another?
And how could Paul's family be fleeing from Aretas on 37 CE if this is somehow happening in the 4th century? And
it would.
And also,
what's the motive? There was a really strong motive. The Jewish War cost a
right.
million lives.
Right.
There was a real reason.
As many Jews as possible.
Right. Romans had a real emergency on their hands. And
yeah.
I don't see that with Constantine at all. So
Right. The opposite. The Jewish problem had been fully contained by the third
and
century.
And on top of that, people that create that huge conspiracy theory don't really understand how many claims they're making. They think, oh, it's just one big claim. No, it's not. It's a lot of claims. There's subsets of those claims. Like, okay. Well, then Origen is a forgery. And then
right.
Ignatius
Tertullian,
is a forgery.
Origen,
all the early church
all
fathers are
writers
forgeries.
Said to, right. I know the manuscripts are medieval, but the pre-Nicene fathers... most of them are not Catholic or Orthodox saints, by the way, because they say things that are against later orthodoxy.
The Papyrus 52 manuscript of John, as Bart Ehrman would often say, is a sizable little credit card dating to like the late 2nd century CE. Well, how is that there?
Right.
This is
right.
happening in all
but are
the
you gonna, But are you going to invent writers like Tertullian and Origen who are
right.
so funky that they won't be canonized, even though they're
And Marcion, too.
Right, or Marcion. Why would you invent heresies at all? Arian heresies, Gnostic heresies, and so forth, just to what? Refute
If I
them?
had to guess, they're probably the people that defend the Constantinian origin theory, but I might say, well, they had to create those fictional heresies to make it look good.
And therefore wipe out whole groups and cause them to hide documents at Nag Hammadi, Egypt?
Right.
No,
you
no.
know, I'll just give a funny little story about how that kind of confirmation bias can work when you're trying to think about a new theory or advance a theory. There was a guy who said that he had studied Bigfoot for 40 years, and he had been looking for Bigfoot all throughout the Pacific Northwest, and he found not one single hair or hide of Bigfoot. And so his conclusion was there must be, not only does Bigfoot exist, but there must be a whole underground civilization of highly sophisticated
a more preposterous theory to explain the theory that has no evidence.
Who surface at night and are able to comb the entire landscape, removing every single hair and piece of DNA and proof that they exist.
They're really good at hiding their tracks, covering their tracks too.
How else could there be no evidence?
Yeah, right? Exactly. Because how else the evidence is gone? They must be really good at you covering their tracks.
You know, the Constantinian theory kind of reminds me of the Christian conspiracy theory that a lot of them talked about. Like, okay, so Satan or God planted dinosaur bones everywhere to test our faith.
Exactly.
I mean, they might as well say that's what's going on with the manuscripts.
Exactly. Tyrannosaurus and Stegosaurus bones were put there to test our faith,
that's
to make
right.
us think that 100 million years ago there were these dinosaurs roaming the earth when it's all a lie. No.
Right. Right. Proof of God.
Proof of God, in fact. In fact, using the proof of evolution, right, and different life eras to show that there's a God. Exactly. Yes. It's completely on its head.
Yes, because all of this phony, these planted fake evidence, it shows there must be a God.
Shows there must be. It's so brilliantly planted and so convincing, and there's no contrary evidence. The fact that there's no contrary evidence conclusively proves it.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
No, this has been a fun conversation, Jacob.
Yeah, it has.
Thank you for letting
us
explain.
I think both. Yeah, I think both.
Thank you for letting us explain how we developed our theory.